Okay, folks, this is Elvin Shamrock here. I want to welcome you again to our bi-weekly teleseminar. And since we're getting new participants every time, I just want to share with you how, for those who are new, how it works. We invite people during the week to send in questions, concerns, cases on their cases they're not sure how to handle. We give them a different code to get in so that they can be active participants, because I've muted everyone out except the active participants and myself. And then we just can discuss those issues. And I've got the I receive an email of the case that's been submitted, and beyond that, this is unscripted, and I have a rough idea what conversation we're going to have, but there's nothing specific, and it can go wherever it goes. The one central theme is I will always make sure that the material is relevant to everyone, even though it's a question that pertains to a particular candidate. So that's the background story. Let's get right on with the first situation. And I just want to check, Nizanin, are you there? Our active participant, Nizanin, are you there?
Yes, you can call
okay.
me now.
Naz, okay, Naz, thank you so much for joining and volunteering. I appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Naz, I have your email that you sent in to the office sometime during this past week. I have it in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
But for the sake of everyone listening in, I want you to present it as succinctly as you can so we can hear what the issues are and then dissect it out and see how we can best approach this issue. So go ahead.
Sounds good. So this patient is a 29-year-old D3 P2 with longstanding history of dysmenorrhea and heavy menstrual bleeding. She has tried Depo-Provera injections, Skyla, and 2-Nexplanon for the past, I believe, 10 to 14 years. And she's had some relief with bleeding and pain with all of them, and Nexplanon was working the best. But the Nexplanon stopped working 2 years in, so we replaced it, basically. And then
sorry, I missed the last, but she got what? What was the very last thing you said?
So I discussed like what she failed, and Nexplanon was working for her, but 2 years in, she started having still like very heavy bleeding and dysmenorrhea.
She broke through. Okay.
Yeah. So she requested to replace the Nexplanon, and we did that for her. So that was the second Nexplanon, but then again, she still didn't get any relief with that. Still was having heavy menstrual bleeding and severe dysmenorrhea, and she was asking for a hysterectomy. So I offered, and she didn't want to do biopsy in the clinic, so I offered her hysteroscopy, DNC, and diagnostic lab. On the diagnostic lab, I did see a few endometriosis lesions on the right left uterus sacral, and I was going to remove them, but they were near structures that near ureter, and I slightly full graded them and documented it. So the biopsy came back normal without any malignancy or hyperplasia.
I want to interrupt for 1 second, Naz.
Yeah.
You fulgurated some of the endometriosis on the uterosacrals and areas near the ureters. Where did you biopsy from? Or are you talking about the DNC specimen?
Yet.
You did not. So
that was the DNC, the hysteroscopy.
Okay. I'll come back to this, but go ahead, carry on.
Yeah. And then, so
just by the way, you're in the exam. Uh-huh. The examiner will not give you this amount of time to present. You can summarize everything you've said so far. She had persistent, chronic, recurrent AUB, which failed to respond to multiple different types and courses of medical therapy. And that pretty much, and they can then ask, well, what were they? And that's fine. That's an appropriate question. But then you're giving them the option to drill down where they want to drill down. And you're ready to roll on that kind of question. But you got to, folks, you got to be able to present as succinctly as possible. And now this is not just your issue. It's an issue with 99% of candidates. So I'm encouraging all of you to just be aware of this. Okay, sorry, carry on.
So we talked about the failure and also after the diagnostic lab, she still came back and discussed other options such as Mirena IUD with a higher dose of levonorgestrel and also other option, but she has migraine with Aura. And so the estrogen-containing options weren't okay for her. So she requested a hysterectomy after lengthy conversation with her. She consented, consented her for a hysterectomy and performed it. And then on the pathology, I did not get anything back. Very normal. So called pathologist.
Can I just interrupt for 1 second?
Yeah.
On the email that you sent me, the weight of the specimen wasn't present. What was the weight?
Oh, sorry.
That's okay, but folks, it's an important bit of information.
Yeah.
Let me just go off at a tangent for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in the ABOG bulletin. All of you need to have the weight of every uterus that you remove, and you also need to have the size of any pelvic mass that you remove, an axial mass. And the size typically or preferably should be the ultrasound size. Because that's the size that you got pre-op, and that was the size that you was part of your working diagnosis. But if you don't have that, then the clinical size, you know, number of weeks would be also adequate. Or you can say the pathology specimen will often give you the size as well. So between those three options, you need to mention that. So can you recall offhand what the weight was on the specimen?
93 grams.
Okay, so let me ask you if you've already done, these are two separate, well, actually, let me back off. Are you finished presenting, or was there anything else you wanted to say?
Yeah, no, I've just, you know, I just wanted to mention that I did contact the pathologist to also look on the posterior side on the left of the serosa to see if he can see any endometriosis. And he did that, and he couldn't see anything.
Okay.
Yep.
So what we have, folks, and why I like this case as one to discuss on a teleseminar is because the expected pre-op diagnosis doesn't match the post-op finding. And now we have Nazia, who feels terrible because she whipped out a uterus on a sweet young 30-year-old, and there was no pathology. Okay? So, Nazia, just let me tell you, in my exam, I had a case on my case list where I did a... it was extremely aggressive even for those days because this was some time ago. I did a THBS nerve on a 29-year-old and got back no pathology, okay? Not even adenomyosis. And, they grilled me in the exam, but I knew it was coming. I was ready, and I cleaned up. Mm-hmm. They were very impressed at the end of the day. So answering your concern from 50,000 feet, yes, this is an issue you've got to be prepared to discuss. And any of you have, a lot of you listening in will have similar cases, young age hysterectomies, etc. This is very relevant for you. From 50,000 feet, they're going to ask it of you. But once you're adequately prepared, this seemingly problematic case actually turns out to be a fantastic asset, and one that you can really shine in the exam. So don't get depressed for those of you who've got cases like this. Getting back to, let's just dissect out this case right now. Naz, I'm assuming, obviously, there were two admissions. The one you did the diagnostic scope and DNC, and the second one was the LAVH, and you say you did a left self-injectomy cystoscopy. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of issues that we need to talk about here. The first question, I've already mentioned it. I'm going to delve a little bit into oral exam technique, folks, because I want you to, even though you're all in the peak of caseless season, I want you to start thinking about this, because in 4 weeks' time, your caseless our collection is done, and in 7 weeks, you're going to be finish your cases. You've got to start thinking about oral exam technique. So the question to you, Naz, is how can you do a hysterectomy on a 30-year-old? What are you going to say?
Well, she was done with her future fertility. We've tried different medications for her dysmenorrhea and also heavy menstrual bleeding. She wanted definitive management, and she was counseled on the risk totally, and that's what she wanted to do. And
okay. I'm going to pause, and everyone, I'm going to give you my defense to the same question that I posed to Naz. And I'm basically going to give the same facts, but with a different tone. And I want you to tell me which you think sounds better if you're the examiner. So you're acting as the examiner. You say to me, Dr. Shamroth, how can you remove a uterus on such a 30-year-old, such a young patient? I would respond in the following manner. I agree. I think 30 years old is a tragic age at which to undergo a hysterectomy. And this really was a tragic situation. However, given her circumstances, her completion of a family history, of her fertility, no further desire for more children, and the persistent failure of all conservative options of therapy, the last attempt, the last option open to us was to go ahead and do a hysterectomy. And as much as I would have liked to have avoided it, I honestly felt it was the only option available to her. If I were to see this patient again today, I would go through the same procedure, and if I got the same result, I would land up with a hysterectomy again, offering it to the patient. And I can tell you that actually the patient has done very well. But I have to admit, this is a real gynecological tragedy. So, Naz, you're the one who's listening in, and we can all hear you. Did you follow the change in tone, but the difference in tone between yours and my presentation? We said the same thing factually, correct?
Mm-hmm.
But I'm showing a sense of personal dis-ease with being so aggressive. And what I'm leaving the examiner with, all of you listening in, I'm leaving you with the feeling that, wow, this guy will not go ahead and remove a uterus willy-nilly. He will really do his utmost to exhaust conservative options before resorting to such aggressive therapy. It's what am I, in a nutshell, it speaks to conservatism. And folks, you have to push conservatism throughout the exam. So, Naz, does that make sense to you?
Yes. Yes. No.
And it's absolutely fine to say in the exam, you know, this horrifies me as well. You can say that. Mm-hmm. I too think this was very aggressive, but for her it was the best thing. You can share your inner thoughts, and you can actually say those things. It actually comes across very well. You come across as being real, and you come across as showing that you have integrity. which is really important in an oral exam. So for any of you who didn't notice until I mentioned it, that a 30-year-old hysterectomy is a major issue for a candidate in the exam, you're not going to forget that now. And I will tell you, folks, outside of those of you that have a C-hist, or a or a postpartum hemorrhage hysterectomy, or a hysterectomy for cancer, all of these being under age 45. Okay, if you've got low 40s, it's still regarded as young. And today we're seeing hysterectomies on case lists occasionally on 21-year-olds who are transgenders going through definitive surgery. So I'm not referring to those scenarios of young age hysterectomy, and they're very few and far between. I'm talking about the run of the mill, the chronic pelvic pain, the dysmenorrhea, the AUB kind of hysterectomy. So this is one of them that NASA just presented. And if you've got a case like this on your list, you've got to be prepared to defend it. And I encourage every single one of you to be totally comfortable to discuss how you counsel a patient regarding hysterectomy. Okay? Very important. Now, let's move on to another issue. Nowhere did you mention doing a uterine endometrial ablation. Did you consider this as a option? Because remember, when you talk about conservative options, I want you, and you can even write this down on your case list. In terms of treatment, the last thing will be hysterectomy. But before that, you write failed medical therapy, and I want you, I want to encourage you to also write failed conservative surgical therapy, which would include things like DNC laparoscopy, uterine artery embolization, endometrial ablation. So what's the story? You see, you're missing something here, Naz, and the take-home message, one of several that I want you folks to get, is you need to show, especially with respect to hysterectomies, but on all patients that you take to the OR, that you've exhausted all conservative options before taking the patient to the OR. And I don't see the endometrial ablation option here. So you've got to defend that. What happened in that regard, Naz?
So I did counsel her on conservative surgical management, including endometrial ablation. But she said she wanted a definitive management.
That's fine. But just understand, you've got to be prepared to discuss that.
Yes.
And as a general principle, after counseling, whenever a patient declines whatever it is you're counseling about, declines a certain treatment, a certain surgical procedure, whenever they decline, especially when they decline, be prepared to discuss how you counsel the patient. When a patient declines TOLAC, you've got to be able to explain how did you counsel them, because they want to make sure that you gave them a fair accounting of the pros and cons of a TOLAC or an external cephalic version, and that you're not inadvertently through a personal bias, subconscious or consciously, pushing them in one direction or another. So as a general rule, whenever you've got to know counseling for any procedure that you do, but whenever you've got a patient you're going to write down or you're going to say in the exam, she declined this option during counseling, be able to describe how you counseled her. Okay? So you've got the endometrial ablation area taken care of. Let's move on to these are not things that you raised in your email to me, Naz, but when you look at this case from the examiner's point of view, these are issues that are screaming to be asked, and it's so easy to predict these questions. And folks, this is what I want all of you to do. Look at your case as it reads, every case on your list, as it reads, look at it from the examiner's point of view and say to yourself, if I were the examiner, what would I ask? And I can tell you, every issue that I've raised so far, none of them are the concerns that NAS presented to me, but they are relevant from the examiner's point of view, and that's what I want you to get used to, looking at your cases from the examiner's point of view. Next point you mentioned, how comfortable NAS are you with describing the course of the ureter?
Planning to study it a little bit better.
Okay, yes. As is pretty much everyone who's listening in. But I think everyone can see, NAS even said it was very close to ureters. But even if she didn't say that, she's describing adhesions right near where the ureters are. And it's an obvious question that's got to come out. So most of you have the potential, based on cases on your case list, to be asked this question. So I encourage you to be comfortable to talk about it. A good comprehensive answer is about a 20 to 25 second answer, okay? And just by the way, again, I'm not trying to get a plug here, but we do know historically that virtually every single one of you are going to come to our Definitive Board Prep course. We're going to discuss that at the course, so we do have you covered. But in the meantime, just be aware, if you've got a case or you're like what NAS has, or you're just planning on describing surgery near the ureter, near the pelvic sound wall, near the base of the round ligaments, you need to be prepared to talk about the ureter. So I'm not going to go into the specific answer, but just be aware that it's important. Okay, next question, and this is universal for every single person, 100% of candidates in the exam, regardless of the number or kind of hysterectomy that you've got on your case list. If you've got, I will just say, an atypical distribution of hysterectomies. I'm talking about abdominal, vaginal, laparoscopic, or robotic. It's really nothing which is usual. But if it looks a little wonky, your ratios, you've got to be prepared to discuss this. How do you decide whether a uterus is coming out abdominally, vaginally, laparoscopically, or with robotic assistance? And again, we're going to spend about 20 minutes on this one issue alone at the course. So again, we've got you covered. But NAS, how would you defend the fact that you did this as a laparoscopic case and not a TVH? It was a 70-something gram uterus, you said, or 90-gram uterus, I can't remember. How come you didn't do this as a TVH?
Because I did do a diagnostic lab, and I saw endometriosis, and also adhesions. So I was worried about extrauterine disease, so that's why I did laparoscopically.
Okay, so this particular case is very easy to defend. But again, what NAS said is totally fine. I'm going to take this question as NAS, play the role of NAS, and you guys, you folks can play the role of examiner and think to yourself, who presented better? Now, I've been doing this for 30 years, so NAS, don't feel bad. When the examiner asked, this was such a small uterus, why didn't you remove it vaginally? I would respond as follows. You know, I very much would have wanted and preferred to remove this uterus vaginally. In fact, by my thinking, every hysterectomy is vaginal unless contraindicated. And in this particular case, she had previous surgery. I had done the previous surgery. There was endometriosis. There was adhesions. And so I felt on that basis alone, a laparoscopic approach would be better. But even beyond that, when I clinically felt for dissensus, there was not much dissensus at all. She had 2 children, but they were small. The labor was easy. There wasn't difficult stretching of tissues. And the vagina was a very long, narrow caliber vagina. And the infrapubic angle was a little more acute than usual. So for all these reasons, as much as I would have preferred to have done this vaginally, because I believe that's the best way, I think in this particular case, the LAVH approach was the best option. How does that sound to you, Naz?
Perfect. You're right. You're
okay,
longer than
But can you see the difference between your approach and mine? I said everything that you said. I added a few extra things, but I showed shared with the examiner that it, philosophically, in my book, I actually said it in as many words. I will try and do a TVH wherever I can. You see, what I'm doing is I'm sending a message to the examiner. I am conservative philosophically, and I'm not going to do wild and wonderful stuff. I'm conservative, and that's exactly what the examiner wants to see in a candidate. So does that all make sense to you, Naz?
Yes, it does. And I have another question. So
yeah, sure.
Is that okay? So in general, on my case list, I have a lot of hysterectomy just because I joined a practice that four other doctors just retired right before I come.
Yeah, so there's a backlog.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
And then so a lot of patients who I got, they already, talked to the other doctors about hysterectomy. They're already, done medication management, but sometimes, declined Nexplanon and IUD and didn't want to get an ablation. Or sometimes they wanted to get ablation. They had BTLs. They had self-injectomies, and I talked to them about the post-ablation pain syndrome. And that's how they ended up in hysterectomy. Now, honestly, didn't want to do this many hysterectomy coming out of the residency.
How do you defend that? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. So should I say
so,
that?
So listen, I'm so pleased you asked this, because the question and answer to this question is classical of what I tell candidates. With 99% of their questions, it's so great. The thing I tell candidates, be totally open and honest. So what I would say, if the examiner, and again, we're veering into oral exam technique now, but if the examiner were to say to me, Dr. Shah, I know you've got 3-4 hysterectomies here on this page, I would say, I was aware that I've got a lot of hysterectomies. I did a lot of hysterectomies this year. In fact, I did, 12. The reason for this is I joined a practice where several of the partners had retired in the few years before I joined. And it's a somewhat underserved area. And there was actually what was tantamount to a backlog of patients who needed surgery, and there was just no one available to do it. So when I came along, there was this backlog before I arrived. In some of these cases, the patients were already partially worked up. Now, I'm coming to a second point, which is really also very important now. So do you understand what I've presented so far? You be totally honest with your examiner. Because can that happen? Absolutely it can, and you just experienced it. So firstly, are you okay with that, Naz?
Yes.
Okay. Now, what was the second part that I wanted to come up with? Yes. You mentioned that some of your patients had already been partially worked up by other members of your prime members of your practice. Whenever a patient's care is handed over from one to another, when you're receiving care, the one receiving the patient, I should say, it's okay to accept the findings and the workup that the patient had previously. But with that being said, you have to be comfortable that the clinical presentation and the workup and evaluation of the patient is such that the surgery that you're going to perform is in fact appropriate. And I tell you where this philosophy, this argument really gets tested. It's not on GYN, it's on OB. It gets tested when an elective repeat C-section is scheduled. Now, today we can do an elective repeat C-section on demand. That's not a problem. But it might be scheduled at 38 weeks of gestation in the absence of any indication not to do it at 39. So the timing can be a problem. And if you've got a case like that, you've got to be able to discuss why did the C-section. Another example is when an induction of labor. Sorry, hello, are you, Naz, can you hear me? Hello?
Yes.
Okay, sorry, I just almost dropped the phone there. Another situation is induction of labor. And here it's also very difficult because a patient may be set up for an induction on your day covering labor and delivery, and you don't agree with the indication or the timing. But at the same time, if it's a difference of a week or the cervix is really unfavorable, I think it is legitimate to tell the patient, you may well need an induction, but this is not the right time. But the bishop is reasonable, and it's maybe just a few days early, it's not really fair to make a patient who's prepared for the last several days for this day to come in for an induction to send her back home. It is very disruptive, not only to her, but her family, her work, and everything. So there has to be a bit of judgment here. And you've got to work your way through that. But the basic principle that I want to drive home as far as every candidate in the exam, every one of you listening in, whatever treatment you meet out, even if it was partially or wholly or done by a colleague, you are the one who's doing the procedure. You're the one who's meeting out the treatment, doing the surgery. You've got to be happy and comfortable with the decision to do the surgery. So that's a long-winded answer, but did I answer your question, Naz, or not?
Yeah, yes. I mean, that totally makes sense. And I did feel comfortable offering hysterectomies to the ones I did, because I definitely got some that they were like, oh, because we're done with babies, we don't want any more kids. I was like, well, that's not the answer,
Good. And you know, folks, to emphasize what I just said earlier, I would say in the exam, one or two patients even came up to me and said, I'm done with babies. I don't need the uterus anymore. But I told them that's not an indication for a hysterectomy. You're showing your independence, you're showing your authority as a consultant who's able to make sound decisions in an isolated population. You're meeting out good care. This is exactly what the examiner wants to see of a potential candidate. Mm-hmm. So, you say that in the exam. It's absolutely fine. Okay?
Okay. So I was wondering, should I volunteer the information or should I wait for them to ask?
So give me an example of which information you're talking, because now we're talking about subtle nuance, and sometimes you want to give it up front, sometimes you don't. Uh-huh. You want to try and get the conversation going without actually saying it. So what kind of conversation are you looking to have that you want to work out how do you write it down? What's the conversation you want?
So I was thinking if in my gyn section they ask me about, the same thing that you asked, let's talk about this hysterectomy case that you've done. And then after I you know, I'm done with explaining that hysterectomy and just say, by the way, you know, I understand I have a lot of hysterectomy on my list because I came to this.
Oh, okay, fine. So you can't really bring in to a particular case a general finding on your case list. You have to do that verbally. That can't be written down, because if you got 2 or 22 hysterectomies on your cases, is irrelevant to the one case that you may want to put it in. You've got to present the one case as it is. And then when you're presenting, you can't write it down on paper, but verbally you can say, you know, this was one of 22 hysterectomies, and my findings for these 22 was ABC. So you can't write that down. Mm-hmm. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, no, I was... Yes, yes.
Okay. All right. Two other things. Naz, you had two surgeries here. Were they done in different hospitals? Because one might have been an outpatient surgery center. It was an overnight laparoscopy. I mean, the same day laparoscopy. The other was hysterectomy. Were they done in the same hospital or different centers?
We do it in the same hospital, and that was my other question. Like, did I put them together? I mean, I'll just...
This is what I'm getting at. If they were done in different cotton hospitals, you've got to get different medical records departments to sign off on each one on their own case. So for those who have patients with two surgeries at different centers, you've got to enter the case twice. But in those cases, let's say the same patient is case number 6 and 25. Under case number 6, you write in parenthesis somewhere, same patient as case number 25, and under case number 25, vice versa. So you're showing the examiner you're being open and honest with them, you're not trying to hide anything, and you're giving them all the information that can help them understand the case better. So that's number one. But if you folks have, as does Naz have, two surgeries done at the same hospital, then it should be one admission. And what I encourage you to do, if you've got to compress two admissions or two surgeries into one case, ask yourself, which is the major surgeon, the most meaty, chunky bit of academic intervention that the examiner can sink their teeth into? And I think you would all agree in this particular case that now presented, the admission for the hysterectomy is the major one. So if that's your decision, I'll give an example where it might be the opposite. You do a laparoscopy for chronic pelvic pain, outpatient surgery, and she gets admitted 2 days later with evidence of an acute abdomen. She had a perfed, ruptured or interrupted bowel injury. So in that scenario, the bowel injury laparotomy would be the major surgery, and the first surgery would also be of secondary importance. It depends. Sometimes it's the primary surgery, sometimes it's the secondary surgery, sometimes it's the intended surgery, sometimes it's not the intended surgery. You've got to, what's the most major event? So in this case, the hysterectomy is the most major event. And so what I would do in the diagnostic column, or in the diagnostic column, I would write AUB dysmenorrhea, failed medical therapy, failed conservative surgical therapy, in parenthesis, laparoscopy and hysteroscopy DNC. And you've put it all down. Now, if medical records questions you, you can say, look, I've referenced it, here it is. and I'm not allowed to put it down twice, the same patient twice on a case list. And if the examiner asks you, it's all there, and the rest, you can elaborate verbally. So that's what I would do with that one. Okay, are you comfortable with that, Naz?
Yes.
Okay, good. Now, I've got two more issues. Naz, wouldn't it have been nice if the pathologist would have found something, found nothing, correct?
It was really nice, yep.
They found nothing. You feel a little sheepish when that happens. I just want to give a bit of advice. Yeah, so all of you need to train your pathologist that if they don't give you a diagnosis of adenomyosis, which would fit beautifully in your case, Naz, you've got dysmenorrhea and abnormal uterine bleeding. If they don't give you a diagnosis of adenomyosis, you get on the phone and you say, you know, clinically, I'm pretty convinced this patient has adenomyosis. Please, can you take a second look? And oftentimes, if they just take enough cuts of the specimen, they will find adenomyosis. And if you train your pathologist that if they don't give you a diagnosis of adenomyosis first time round, they're going to be looking at that specimen a second time. If you train them that way, you might find that the incidence of adenomyosis goes up in all your pathology specimens. Now, I say that a little tongue-in-cheek, but to some extent, it's true. So just think about that. And you can say, again, in the interest of being totally open and honest, in the exam, you could say, you know, I've got to be honest, I was expecting at the very least for there to be adenomyosis, but there was nothing. You say that. And the fact that there was nothing, this is important to everyone listening in. The fact that you find nothing on pathology or you find something but it doesn't match what you were expecting, that can happen not infrequently in GYN. And so it's okay to some extent if it happens. And if you feel you're in a situation where it's okay, and this is certainly a case where it's okay, say so. You know, I was expecting adenomyosis. I was surprised not to find anything. It's okay to say that, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And now the last point. Wow, folks, you see how one simple, pretty straightforward hysterectomy. We've been talking about this one case for over half an hour, and every single point has been certainly very valid. So, you know, you've got to go through your cases with a fine tooth comb. That's the point I'm trying to make here. Anyhow, the last point I want to make, which is relevant for everyone, is now, I don't think you said it now on this call, but in your email, you did write that at the time of laparoscopic hysterectomy, you did do a cystoscopy. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. What is your opinion regarding the role of cystoscopy following laparoscopic hysterectomy?
So there's not much evidence there's both evidence actually going for or discussing against the cystoscopy, reversal cystoscopy after hysterectomy.
Can you just repeat that? I didn't quite hear you. Are you saying there is or is not a place for universal cystoscopy? I missed that.
So there is both discussion for and against universal cystoscopy. I usually definitely do cystoscopies when there is severe adhesion.
What's your opinion regarding universal cystoscopy in the absence of any concern? But the indication is that she had a laparoscopic hysterectomy. What's your opinion of doing cystoscopy in that situation for no other reason but the fact that she had a laparoscopic hyst?
I do. I mean, honestly, I do universal cystoscopy.
Okay, so I'm so pleased we're having this conversation.
Yeah.
And for everyone listening in, this is really important. This is a favorite kind of question for the exam. There has been a fair amount of controversy over this, but there have been several articles in the last several years. One was a committee opinion. In fact, I think there were two committee opinions going back a few years ago, as well as there was an MOC article, if I remember correctly, on this issue. Bottom line, you can do a cystoscopy following a laparoscopic hysterectomy for any indication, no matter how small the bar for doing a cystoscopy following laparoscopic hysterectomy is very low. So any concern that you've got, go ahead and do the cystoscopy, but it should, the indication for cystoscopy should not be simply that she had a laparoscopic hysterectomy. In other words, laparoscopic hyst on its own is insufficient. It's got to be laparoscopic hyst plus X. And X can be very inconsequential, but there has to be something else. And you actually said, I prompted you, Naz, and if you actually said, yeah, you'll do it universally. And that's the very point. Now, for many of you, you're probably thinking, oh my goodness, I've got cystoscopy on all my laparoscopic hits. What the hell am I going to say? And there's a way out, very easy. You say, when they ask you about this particular case, I would answer the following. I would say, you know, this case is similar to six other cases on my case list. In all of these six cases, I did a laparoscopic hysterectomy, and I did do a cystoscopy on all of them. In each of these six cases, there was some level of concern. In two of them, I was operating close to the ureter. In another one, I had to put a stitch very close to the ureter. In one case, there were adhesions. I fulgurated near. So in all of these cases, there was some element of concern which prompted the cystoscopy. But if I'm doing a case and everything goes well and there's no concern at all, then in my opinion, the cystoscopy is no longer warranted. This was just a bad – in fact, I used this line in my exam. This was just a bad year for collecting cases because all my laparoscopic tests landed up with cystoscopies. Does that make sense to you? How does it sound to you, Naz?
Sounds great.
Okay, good. Thank you. You can say it sounds terrible. I've got broad shoulders. I can take the insult. Don't be shy.
No, I'm okay with it. I swear.
Okay, all right. All right. So look, Naz, I think we've discussed everything that you wanted on this case. I brought up a boatload of other issues. Are you comfortable? Is there anything else you want to mention? Or because I want to close off, and there are a couple of comments I've got to make. Well, I'll talk to you about MOC articles in just a moment, but before we do that, any other questions that you have, or is that it?
No, that's it. Thank you so much.
Okay, good, good, good. Okay, folks, I'm in the middle of reviewing the MOC maintenance of certification articles that have been released thus far. And just by the way, when we've got the complete list of articles, they usually get released round about August. We will give them out to all of you at our definitive board prep course. And we'll give you the list just that you should go through it. And I'm not saying you need to read these 45 articles. I'm not saying that at all. But if you've got a case on your case list in which one of these articles is fairly closely allied to the kind of conversation you think you're going to have based on what you've got in your case, then it behooves you to possibly read a little bit more. Not much, just a little bit more in that particular article, on that particular article. So I'm busy. I have to read these articles, as does your examiners, because we have to maintain our board certification status. And this is one of the requirements. You will start doing this next year. So why am I bringing this all up? Because there are two review articles which are very exam relevant, and virtually all of you have a case or two or three on your list which pertains to at least one of the issues in one of the at least one of the articles. So what do these two articles revolve around? The one is a review article on endometrial hyperplasia, and the other is a review article on endometrial cancer. So related articles, and if ABOG wants all board certified physicians to read them, they've nominated these as they voted these articles as articles that are worthy of being read by every OBGYN, then it's not a bad idea that you folks as candidates in the board exam be A, familiar with what they want us to know, and perhaps even more important, if this is what your examiner is reading, which we know he or she has to read, if that's what they're reading, it behooves you to read that as well, because you want to get yourselves in sync with your examiner as far as what they're reading is concerned. So we will give you the exact reference. Don't worry about that. But you should just know at this time that endometrial hyperplasia, which is very important from the exam point of view, and endometrial cancer, which a small but significant number of you have on your case list, that's also important, and there are articles out on them. You should be briefly familiar with them. So that's it. First of all, folks, before you go, every now and then I make this request. I'm going to do it again today. Can I ask you all, please, before, just immediately after you hang up the phone, can you send an email to info@examPro.com, and just rate this teleseminar on a scale of 1 to 5, 1 being lousy, 5 being excellent. We really appreciate getting feedback every now and then. It helps us tremendously. And if you want to add extra comments, that's absolutely fine. They can be negative. Just keep them constructive. Although I would like to think there probably aren't going to be any negative comments. But feel free to say whatever you feel is appropriate. But at the very least, rate it on a scale of 1 to 5, 1 lousy, 5 excellent, what you feel of this. And do it right away, because if you don't do it right away, it's not going to happen. And we really would appreciate it if you could do that. So with that being said, Naz, I want to thank you for volunteering. Folks, the rest of you, please, volunteer for future teleseminars. It's free. It's a good opportunity. Naz, did you find this helpful to be on the hot seat and interact the way you did? Be honest.
Yes, I did. I didn't want to be the one. I'm sure there's not a lot of nurses out there, but it's really helpful in general. So.
Okay, and what you just heard from Naz say is exactly right. No one wants to do it. You feel very uncomfortable, but once you bite the bullet and actually do it, you feel very good. You realize how helpful it was, and you feel good at having done it. So I encourage you to do that. Notice I never mentioned her last name, so you remain anonymous. And so even if you answer something incorrectly, no one will know who you are. So I encourage you to volunteer. I encourage you to come back. Tell your friends about us. Come and join. And that's it. So, folks, our next teleseminar will be in 2 weeks' time. That's the 18th of June. And we'll do this all then. So thank you very much, Naz. Thank you very much to everyone who joined in. And this then concludes our teleconference. Thanks so much, folks. All the best. Bye-bye.